Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Welcome to the JAPA podcast for the April 2018 issue. In this podcast, we summarize select articles from this month's JAPA. I'm your co-host, Adrienne Banning, faculty member and now research coordinator and EBM course director at the Drexel PA program in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And I'm your co-host, Christopher Madej, program director at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center PA program in Memphis, Tennessee. So, yay, new role at Drexel.
I know. Isn't it exciting?
It is exciting. This is it's always fun to move into new parts within your program and new opportunities and scary new things to do. So that's fun.
Yeah, scary. Mm-hmm. Yep. It is like a big SWOT analysis, right? Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. But I think if you've been listening, you know, I feel really strongly that research, especially in the PA profession, about us but outside, is how we communicate with ourselves and the profession. It's our story. So I'm happy to have a role to help move the profession forward in that way. It's exciting.
To each their own. Everybody needs to do it. I do not want to. So kudos for you to pick up that mantle and run with it.
Thank you. We have some interesting research and some topics to talk about here in April.
We do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this month in this April edition, we're going to talk about a fairly rare condition called Sandifer syndrome, managing pressure injuries. And then we're going to have some conversation about animal bites. We're going to talk about this month's editorial from Reimer Burchard about too many pills, and then do a quick QRS review of rotator cuff injuries, and finally some original research on patient awareness of STI testing.
Yeah.
So we have a question from the editor, and so Adrienne, if you were a kid's cereal, which one do you identify with the most and why?
I know. This is one heck of a question. This was really hard at first because they have weird names, right? Like, and a lot of them are flaky. So I was like, I don't think I'm flaky. I chose, which maybe isn't, I guess it could be a kid's cereal, but I chose it for its versatility. I chose, what the heck is it called now? Rice Krispies. I chose Rice Krispies because they are really versatile. They can get a little rambunctious, right? But you can have them for breakfast. You can mix them with butter and marshmallows and it's dessert. You can put them on chicken and then that's a main course. So I just felt like it was a pretty versatile, will kind of work wherever you put it. And I'd like to think that about myself.
Well, that's pretty good. I actually didn't think about that spin.
What was your choice?
You know, I really struggled with this because I'm really not a cereal person.
This was a hard question.
Yeah, you know, I've never really eaten a lot of cereal. I don't really think that there is one in particular that's kind of my go-to. Like if I'm craving cereal, like this is what I'm going to eat. But you know, the more I thought about it, the more I was like, you know what? I'm probably just Wheaties. Like I'm just a you know, kind of boring.
Breakfast
but
of champions.
Breakfast of champions, right? And yeah. and that was kind of where I went with it. Was if you were to ask anybody on the street, if you were, you know, what's the coolest cereal that's out there, or you know, if you know, what's the first cereal that comes to mind? Everybody always thinks about Wheaties just because of their, you know, their marketing campaign during the 80s. And being a child of the 80s, I remember you know, all of that. So That's probably it. I don't think it necessarily resonates with me in any way, shape, or form, other than just it's the breakfast of champions, and I am a champion. So we're just gonna leave that out there.
Cue Chariots of Fire.
Yes.
Well, having said that, now you know what breakfast cereals we are. Mm-hmm. Which is a sentence I never thought I'd say. Yeah. Here's another disclaimer. This podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition. We share our take and opinions, and they don't represent JAPA, the authors, or the editor's opinions, or the publisher. And this isn't intended as medical advice. We're going to jump right in with the CME, and a reminder about the CME articles. When you read both CME articles, you review the post-test and then take the test online. at, you can Google it, CMEAAPA.org, you need to get at least 70%, and then you get one category, one CME for both articles. So don't forget to get your CME.
That's right.
The first CME article we're just going to go over really briefly, and that's on this rare Sandifer syndrome, but important to know about because you can really send someone through extensive testing. So what do we know about it? First of all, this article is written by Deborah M. Moore, PAC. She practices at Dawes Family Medicine in Santa Maria, California, and Denise Rizzolo, PAC, PhD, Assistant Clinical Professor at the PACE Completion Program in New York City, Associate Professor in the School of Nursing at Keene University in Union, New Jersey, and an Assessment Specialist for the Physician Assistant Education Association, and neither author has any conflicts. So in summary, Sandifer syndrome is this posturing that's associated with GERD, either GERD with or without hiatal hernia, and it's rare. So maybe about 1% of kids who have GERD, but that's still, 1% is still 1 in 100. So if you put 100 kids with GERD in a room, one of them might have the Sandifer syndrome. So that, I don't know, it's rare, but it kind of sounds like actually a lot of kids to me. Mm-hmm. It's when there is specific posturing, and that's called apostonic posturing. That's where the kid's head and heels go back and their spine arches forward and there's intermittent torticollis. It's a spasmodic torsional dystonia and it's transient. So if you're seeing this, I mean, if I were a parent, I would think that it's a seizure, right? And that could be really scary, but it's not epilepsy because there's no rhythmic or clonic component. However, to make it a little more complicated, kids with epilepsy can still have this. You can have a kid with epilepsy who also has GERD and Sandifer syndrome, which would make it a little harder to diagnose. So it's this really kind of specific type of dystonia. It's important to know about it because I'm sure you can imagine that kids could get evaluated for lots of other things first, leading to discomfort, worry, increased costs. So if you're evaluating a child who's doing this posturing, ask yourself if they have GERD, and maybe it's even undiagnosed GERD if it's a kid who doesn't already have known neuromuscular disease. You don't really need any tests. It's diagnosed with history and physical, bread and butter for PAs. The important part is the history of GERD, and then basically you just treat the GERD through meds or maybe even surgery. So there's this thing, it's called Sandifer syndrome. It's easily misdiagnosed, and now you know about it.
You know, I'm gonna have to admit that I had never heard of this before.
No, and me either. I did not know it existed.
No, and you know, I try to pride myself on medical eponyms, and this is one that completely it took me by surprise. It's interesting. It's kind of one of those pimp questions that you're gonna get asked about on rounds where some old attending is gonna ask you about, you
Dr.
know,
Dr. Sandifer.
Yeah, right. Or, you know, a seizure in a kid with GERD, what do you want to think of? But, it, you know, from a clinical standpoint, it's just like, no, just treat the primary condition. They should be fine.
Mm-hmm. So, but if you see some rare posturing, I mean, ask if the kid. And I guess when they interviewed older kids, you know, why do you do that? Or does it, when you do that movement, does it help? The older kids said, yeah, it makes it feel better, the GERD symptoms. So there might be some.
And there may be something to that. I mean, if they're going into an apostotonous posturing, which is the posturing that you think of with tetanus as well. That's that old school picture where the only thing touching the ground is the occiput and the heels. Mm-hmm. I guess you could make the argument from a physiologic anatomical standpoint that it's stretching the esophagus out. So if they've got a hiatal hernia, I guess it would kind of pull it back into the peritoneum instead of having it sliding back up into the thorax. So maybe. I think it's kind of an aggressive thing to do to try to do that, but again, kids are resilient and they are very MacGyvery when it comes to
MacGyvery.
Doing things that are going to help them, kind of like the tet posturing in the tetralogy of Fallot. Like they run around, they get blue, short of breath, they squat down, they grab their knees, they get better, they hop up and they go run around again. You know, so
I'll fix this.
Yeah. So it's just
I've got play time happening here.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So a cool article though, very cool article.
Yeah. So,
all right. So next one we're going to touch on is managing pressure injuries beyond skin deep. And this is by author Daniel Pod, PAC, associate professor at St. John's University in New York City and practicing PA who practices in geriatrics at Long Island Queens Medical Center. So what's the definition of a pressure injury? It is an area of increased, unremitting pressure over bony prominences resulting in tissue ischemia and necrosis. 70% of these are going to occur in the hip and pelvis region on the ischial tuberosity, trochanter, and sacrum is what we think of. But you also don't want to think about the other ones in patients who are bedridden or otherwise incapacitated, the occiput, the heels, the elbows. You always want to do a good skin exam on those patients. So what are the numbers with pressure injuries? About 1 to 3 million cases a year. A third of these occur in either acute hospitalizations, long-term care facilities, or home care settings, such as nursing homes or long-term acute care centers. And there's 60,000 deaths from complications, which I think is a huge, huge amount in a condition that really is largely preventable as long as you take vigilance with it. It's kind of like mechanical ventilation pneumonia. You know, yes, it kind of comes with the territory, but if you do good pulmonary rehab, you should be able to avoid it. And that's kind of how I feel about pressure ulcers.
I was kind of thinking the same thing. That's a large
number.
That's
a very large number, right. Yeah. So the risk factors and the pathogenesis that we see with it is pressure is obviously the first one, and this has to do with immobility. So you want to think about patients who are either neurocognitively incapacitated, or if they're in the hospital due to other medical problems and they're chemically sedated or paralyzed or in the intensive care unit, you want to think about that. Friction and shear is also another one. So anytime a patient is sitting up in bed and they're starting to slide down the bed, their skin is going to stick to the sheets or to the bed, and then that pressure is then going to move the subcutaneous tissue over top of the dermal tissue, and that can cause some separation between the layers. Obviously, increased moisture can cause some problems, so this is why the sacrum becomes such a big deal in bedridden patients, because soiling and urination can lead to breakdown of the skin due to that increased moisture. Age over 65 has an increased risk factor due to the fact that they get sarcopenic, which means that they sort of lose their subcutaneous fat and they get more fat intra, sort of muscularly, intra-abdominally, those kind of things. So they have decreased subcutaneous fat and decreased capillary blood flow to their skin, which can lead to that ischemia. And then obviously nutrition. As your protein levels drop, your albumin, your prealbumin, or just poor nutrition, then the collagen that makes up the dermal layers is going to break down, and it's going to lead to decreased dermal structures and dermal integrity. There's two different grading scales, and I'm just going to touch on both of these because you can go to the article and look. There's the Braden scale, which is the most common for those of you that work in the hospital setting and you're reading your notes from your wound ostomy nurses or your therapy colleagues. There's six criteria. They're all graded within there. You get a scoring system that increases your risk of developing a pressure ulcer. There's also the Norton scale, which is five criteria. Same deal, scoring system, and it predicts the risk of developing an ulcer. Now, the big thing is the appearance and the actual grading. So we're going to go through the stages real quickly. So stage one is a non-blanchable erythema of intact skin. So the skin's intact, but there's non-blanchable erythema. So you push on it and it does not pink up. It doesn't get white and then pink back up again. There's stage two, which is partial thickness skin loss with exposed dermis. Stage three is full thickness skin loss. Stage four is full thickness skin loss with tissue loss. Then there's unstageable, and unstageable just means that there's eschar or there's exudates or there's other things that are obscuring the margins of the ulcer, and it's very hard to stage unless you do some debridement. Now, the important thing that you want to remember is that once it's staged initially, it permanently retains that diagnostic stage despite healing. So just because they start with a stage three and then over the course of several weeks of being treated, it goes to a stage one, it doesn't then become a stage one. It's always a stage three. It's just in various stages of healing. Once it's healed, then it comes with the sort of suffix of closed. So it would be a stage three closed. And then that way you're using the right terminology with your colleagues. Laboratory workup with it, since this is more of a clinical diagnosis, you don't really need anything to specifically diagnose it, but the things you want to worry about is obviously osteomyelitis and progression of an infection to the exposed bone. So things that would suggest osteomyelitis in somebody with a pressure ulcer would be a white blood cell count over 15,000 with a neutropenic left shift, elevated ESR or CRP, which are your non-inflammatory markers, or if you do a nuclear bone scan, you're going to see increased uptake along those bone margins on radiography. Monitoring, there is the PUSH tool that is put out by the National Academy for Pressure Ulcers, And this stands for Pressure Ulcer Scaling of Healing. So that's the acronym PUSH. And what you do is you do a cubic centimeter measurement of length and width, and then you get a score based off of that. Exudate, if it's present, what type, and then the tissue type that is exposed. And then so that'll give you an idea of the nomenclature that your colleagues are using as they're managing these ulcers. What do we need to do from a PA standpoint in managing this? Obviously, the first thing is reduce pressure. So this is going to be repositioning patients every 2 hours, keeping the head of bed greater than 30 degrees so that they're not sliding down. Pressure reducing devices, pads, beds. I mean, there's a whole host of different things out there that you want to look at. And this is going to be more what your hospital has and what your nursing staff is using. But you want to make sure that those orders are in and that you're talking with the nursing staff to make sure that this is getting taken care of. Then there's debridement. There's a whole host of different things that you can do from a debridement. The main reasons why you do it is you want to expose good granulation tissue so that the new skin cells can come in and start to epithelialize. It helps reduce infections by getting the necrotic skin and tissue out of there, and it also helps facilitate healing. You can do sharp debridement with scalpels and scissors, mechanical debridement with hydrotherapy and irrigation. There's autolytic, which is the classic wet-to-dry dressings. There's enzymatic, which is a whole host of different things that you can put on a dressing in order to help break it down. And then there's the good old biosurgical, which is using medical maggots to help destroy the tissue and work in there. Obviously, depending on your hospital system, that may or may not be something that you can use, but there's a lot of data out there to support its use. Manage early infections. Use antibiotics as much as you can within reason. You obviously don't want to use them if there's no indications, but you also want to be aggressive in the management if it is infected. You want to use moisture-retaining dressings once you have those wounds debrided, because that will facilitate healing. There's some studies out there that the article quotes as it increases healing rate by up to 25%. You want to facilitate wound cleaning, so this is going to be dressing changes, at least BID. Negative pressure therapy can help, so this could be hyperbaric oxygen or hyperbaric chambers, as well as wound vacs. And then, of course, making sure that their nutrition is up to snuff, making sure that they're getting enough protein, consulting your nutrition service, and making sure that they have all the supplements on board that can help with that. So pressure ulcers, very common in certain settings. You need to be vigilant about it. You need to be doing a thorough skin exam on patients who are at risk for it, and then making sure that you have the right team on board to help manage these should they occur.
Yeah, super common, like you said, but mostly preventable. It just that they happen all the time.
You just got to be vigilant with it.
Yeah. And then enough protein isn't going to prevent it. And remember, if it's happening in older patients, sometimes it's hard for them to chew protein.
Right.
Maybe that's one of the first things that goes. You got to.
Yep. And having your nutrition colleagues come by and helping with managing them and giving recommendations on what the best way to help these patients is going to be beneficial, not only for you, but also for the patient.
Yeah.
So the next thing we're going to talk about is the editorial by Reamer Bouchard, Too Many Pills on the Kitchen Table. Reamer, as you all know, is a PharmD PAC at GW University and is very, very involved in JAPA and published. And I can't say enough about Reamer. And so we're just going to leave that out there for him.
Yeah. So just a good person.
Yeah.
Great PA leader.
Yeah, right.
But also a pharmacist before his life and during his life as a PA. So he brings us these 9 questions that he always asks himself.
Yep. So we're going to kind of review them. They go in depth in the article, so I thoroughly recommend you going and reading about this, but we'll sort of touch on each one of these. So when he walks into a room and he sees the bag of pills, or as he calls them, the little soldiers, as they're lined up on the countertop, what are the things that goes through his mind as a pharmacist as well as a PA on how to take care of the patient? So the first thing he says is this medication necessary? So is each medicine treating an active problem? Sometimes meds just get left on and patients don't question anything, so they just keep filling them, and they call the office and say, hey, I need a refill. You refill it, but you don't really know what it's being treated for. So just making sure you do a good med reconciliation, looking at all the medicines and make sure that each medicine is treating an active condition and not something that has already been treated. You want to then ask, is the drug contraindicated in older adults? So some medicines are safe in younger patients, and as they get older, there may be some contraindications. And if they've been on them for many, many moons, then maybe it's now contraindicated in this particular patient. So just do, again, looking at it, make sure that it's safe, make sure the dosing is safe for older patients before you just go ahead and keep staying the course. Are there any duplicate medications? So not just individual drugs, but drug classes. Obviously, if you've got one doc or one PA that is using the brand name and another one that is using the generic name, they may be treating the same thing, but to the patient, they're two different medicines. So you want to make sure that that's obviously not occurring, but also different drug classes. So different classes can treat a host of different conditions, and it may be that one drug is an anticholinergic and another one is an anticholinergic. They're treating two different conditions where really one of those would be just fine to treat both. So being able to look at that will be helpful in trying to peel back some of these medicines in polypharmacy. Is the patient taking the lowest effective dose? So you always want to take into account renal and liver metabolism. Older individuals do have a degree of renal insufficiency, so those dosages may need to change. And you may be able to decrease the dose, which is not only going to be safer for the patient, but it may actually be cheaper as well. Is the medication intended to treat an adverse reaction from another medication? And this is referred to as drug cascade. So you give one medicine, you have a side effect, you give another medicine to treat that side effect, but that medicine now causes a side effect, so you put another medicine on board. So you really got to look and see, what are all these medicines treating? Is there anything that we can do to try to limit the adverse reactions? And then also, again, trying to peel back things that that may not be necessary. Can you simplify the drug regimen? So again, are they taking one medicine five times a day? Can they get by with one medicine once a day or twice a day? So really look to see, are there other dosings out there? I know that I, the one that comes to mind for me is treating a herpetic outbreak. You could do valacyclovir, which is twice a day, or you could do acyclovir, which is five times a day. So depending on which medicine you pick, it treats the same condition and is just as efficacious, but one is five times a day and one is twice a day, which can be very difficult for your patient to adhere to. And that is going to be helpful in trying to simplify their regimens, because they're going to be able to take their medicine as prescribed instead of maybe missing dosages because it's a weird dosing strategy. Are there potential interactions, not just between drug and drug, but drug and food and drug and over-the-counter? So between our electronic medical records, all of the retail pharmacies, most of the time if something doesn't fire on your EMR, you'll get a call from the pharmacy saying, hey, there's a contraindication or there's an interaction. But sometimes things sneak through. So you want to make sure that you're doing that drug-drug interaction either using a app. Reamer talks about Micromedics, which I like. That's actually one that I learned from my pharmacist friends. But any pharmacology app that you can use where you can type in drugs to make sure there's not any interactions. But drug food, again, the classic one that you remember from school or from students that are listening is grapefruit juice. You want to ask, what kind of diet that they have. Look for specific things that can affect drug metabolism. And then over-the-counter herbal medicines, those kind of things, sometimes you never think to ask about, but they may be taking an over-the-counter that they don't consider a medicine, so they don't put it on the list. So it's always important to bring that up and say, are you taking anything that is not prescribed? Because they may have some interactions in there, and it may be the reason why they got another medicine added to their list. Is the patient adherent? So you want to say, are you taking all of these medicines as prescribed every single day? Because if they're not, then maybe that's a medicine that they don't need. If they're otherwise stable, then maybe if they're only taking something half as often as they should, then maybe that's a medicine that we can take off. And then the last question is the patient taking an over-the-counter herbal supplement or another person's medications? And I highlight the latter of these three because in this day and age with the way that our medical model is, some patients cannot afford their medicines and they might be going over their copays or what have you, and maybe their partner is able to get it at a much cheaper rate. I've seen instances where adults are taking their children's medicines because the kids don't need it, but their insurance plan is better because they're under 18. So you just want to ask about other things that could be affecting how these patients are taking their medicines, because it may be that you can try to get them on some kind of a discount plan or combine medicines, or just really trying to take the best care of your patient as possible when it comes to their medicines that they're taking at home. So I think Reamer did a really good job of sort of letting, you know, peeling the curtain back a little bit into the mind of a pharmacist. And I think these are all things that we can ask very easily and very quickly as the care providers, just so that we're not just punting them either to the next person or to the pharmacist. We can actually try to help our patients out the best that we can. And I think it also helps with our rapport if we sit down and actually go over all of these with them. So great article.
Yeah. I mean, when you can engage a patient and then they know all the medicines that they're taking, I've seen every one of these 9 questions and problems with them in combinations. I think it's a good reminder too that the pharmacist is part of your healthcare team.
Mm-hmm.
They have a huge amount of training and they're make friends with them, go in and shake the hand of your pharmacist, you know, meet them eye to eye. But every single time, I think sometimes too, providers don't want to step on each other's toes. So you get a patient who has meds that you didn't write for, and you don't want to take them off or adjust it because someone else thought it was the right decision. But even then, conversations. So there's just a ton of communication.
Yep.
But definitely a problem for a lot of people.
Yep. Nope. Great article.
Yeah. Thanks. Another great article just happens to be written or co-authored by you.
Woo-hoo!
This month. Yeah. And so this is on Bites. And I remember last summer, I remember because it was just in time for us to cover it in our curriculum, there was another article about bites, but more so stings, right? This was like...
envenomations.
Yeah. So these two together are really going to get you through your next trek out into nature. But it's not just all nature and wildlife here, right? A lot of bites are within the home.
Yep.
Yeah. And so you and John Hurt, who's a PA in Alabama?
Yep. Yep. Former colleague of mine. We worked at UAB for 4 or 5 years until he took over another position at Samford University, which is a new program that's opening up in Birmingham. This was the part 2 of that particular article. We were going to write this all as one big one, but it just got to be just this massive endeavor. So we said, you know what, let's split this up into 2. So this was certainly his brainchild. He was the lead author on both of these. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a good breakdown for clinical PAs to, you know, spiders, snakes, and then now we're getting into the more common animal bites.
Oh, my.
Yeah, yeah.
Spiders, snakes, and more common animal bites. Oh, my. All right. So thank you to John Hurt. We've got you here right now, Chris. So bites, what's the most common type of bite that we see coming through the American healthcare system?
So dogs are the most common, and I think it's just mm-hmm. because there's a lot more dogs that, or people are around a lot more dogs than the other animals that are covered in the article. So you think about all the domesticated animals, and you know they account for the vast majority of them. And depending on the breed and depending on the patient, they can cause a significant amount of damage because again their teeth and what they're designed for is to, you know, do some damage. So mm-hmm. certain breeds, you know, we're not going to get into talking about which ones should be banned or which ones are bad. And
right. We don't want, there's definitely breed bias and each dog is an individual.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. I mean, it's definitely a nature nurture kind of argument. But certain animals, obviously bigger dogs can cause more damage, either intentional or unintentional. But, mm-hmm. you know, the main thing is just taking into account are they owned? So are they feral? Are they, does somebody own them? Are their vaccinations up to date? And really just looking at the underlying tissue damage. For the most part, dog bites don't cause rabies. You know, unless it's a known rabid animal, they typically don't carry rabies. I mean, even stray dogs don't carry rabies. So it's kind of one of those things where you don't have to knee-jerk cover for that. And we'll talk about it a little bit later on in this. Mm-hmm. But the main thing is just taking care of the wound that's in front of you.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading once that especially with bigger dogs, their jaws can exert so much force that not just tissue damage, but you even want to check for skeletal or like bone damage, just because the damage really can come from crushing
right.
as well.
And that's so. Adults and more importantly in kids. when I worked in the emergency room, every dog bite in a child, I always got an x-ray on because...
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, yeah.
Yeah, because they've just got smaller bones. So what may not feel like if somebody says, oh, well, you know, this was just a chihuahua, okay, yeah, but this was in a two-year-old in their hand. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, that can still cause a bone chip. And again, if you've got an extension through the skin into the bone, you may predispose to an osteomyelitis. So you just need to know that mm-hmm. going mm-hmm. into it.
Yeah. And we just had a big holiday weekend and had a little kind of animal respect conversation with a kid in my family. Not that there was any disrespect going on, but just that kids like to hug dogs. I mean, I like to hug dogs, right? But like dogs that I know. But kids sometimes don't know, like, personal space
yeah.
for dogs, or, you know, they just kind of want to hug them and they really love animals, but a little education on dog respect can go a long way.
Yep. Yep. I mean, again, it just kind of comes down to knowing the warning signs. We didn't really get into it, into the article as much, but, you know, just knowing what the warning signs of dogs are, when they're kind of getting to the point where it's like, hey, you know, I'm not cool with you right now. And, you know, keeping an eye on kids. Like, I know with my kids, you know, we had this conversation yesterday, you know, we are animal people. I've mm-hmm. had animals mm-hmm. growing up my entire life. So I mm-hmm. want them to have a healthy respect for it. But at the same time, they can't just run up to a dog and start loving on them. Like, they have to ask if it's okay to pet the animal. And then I tell them to hold their hand out so the animal can smell them. And mm-hmm. you watch for the eyes, the ears, you watch for the tail. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you go into. And again, that kind of goes outside the scope of this article. But the main thing is just proper education in and around animals.
Yeah. Anyone can get bitten by a dog, but kids are most common.
Correct.
Interestingly, for cats, it's not kids. For cats, it's adult women who get bit the most.
Crazy cat ladies.
So maybe a little education there on when to back off.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think that's another thing is that cats just tend to, they're not... I think globally, they're not as social as dogs are, so they kind of want to be left alone. So people just want to go up and start petting on them, and they're quick to bite and quick to scratch. And especially indoor cats that use litter, mm-hmm. You really run into, you know, cat scratch fever and other infections that can occur with those bites and with those scratches that you have to know about. But again, cats, just like domesticated dogs, very low risk for rabies transmission, and that's the main thing that people are going to come in about is, oh, I got bit by my neighbor's cat, I need a rabies shot, and it's going to be more patient education than anything else.
Yeah, but, okay, so low risk of rabies for cats and dogs, but the infection rate is very different, right?
Right, right. Augmentin is going to be your, if you had to put one antibiotic in your back pocket for most of your animal bites, Augmentin is going to get you by. Obviously, if they have a penicillin allergy, doxycycline with clindamycin, maybe a little bit of a fluoroquinolone with that. But for the most part, Augmentin will cover your dog bites, will cover your cat bites. And if you needed to worry about, you know, cellulitis or other kinds of tissue infections from animal bites, that's the antibiotic that you want to keep in your back pocket.
Yeah. And with a dog bite, I think the article said, correct me if I'm wrong, you don't automatically need an antibiotic for a dog bite. But with a cat bite, they're just probably going to get infected.
Right. Right. So dog bites, you know, the solution to pollution is dilution. You just need to rinse it, wash it real good, local wound care, maybe a little antibiotic ointment would be fine. But the low risk of infection, as long as you clean the wound really well. Cat bites, because their teeth and their claws are much thinner, you're dealing more with puncture wounds. And the local skin antimicrobial stuff is just not going to penetrate as much. So most of the time we end up prophylactically covering cat bites, but dog bites you don't necessarily need to.
Yeah, and it depends cosmetically if you're going to suture them for dog bites, but cat bites, because you're basically injecting the microbes right into the skin, not that they, I can't, it would probably be a pretty big cat that you'd need sutures for.
Right, I mean, it used to be that, you know, you didn't suture any animal bites because the thought process was that you just sealed the bacteria in there. But there's mm-hmm. been a lot of good data coming out from our emergency medicine colleagues that say that, look, even large dog bites that cosmetically need to be repaired are still fine to close, because otherwise you're going to have a horribly disfiguring scar. Mm-hmm. So you can still close them, You may need to put some wicks in and you know, allow for some drainage, but you don't have to leave these gaping wounds open and have it heal by secondary intention. You can put a couple sutures in to pull it back together, cover them antibiotic wise from an infection, and then just good wound vigilance.
Okay, so we've covered wounds, and we talked about in dogs and cats, don't panic about rabies, really low risk. But when should we panic about rabies?
So the animals that you need to absolutely need to cover for are going to be raccoons, skunks, foxes, and bats. Those are the big four that you automatically need to. And you know, the classic pants question is, you know, bats. If you see bats on a question, it's absolutely rabies all the way. So if you live in an area where you see that, then you need to be more concerned with it. So those are absolute indications for rabies prophylaxis. The domesticated animals, a lot of times what will happen is you will contact, you know, if it's a neighbor, somebody you have a relationship with, then you just need to observe the animal. If it's a neighbor that you don't get along with, or it's a stray dog, then animal control will typically try to procure the animal and watch them for 10 days. And if there's any signs of sketchy activity, then at that point, then we would initiate rabies prophylaxis and rabies treatment. You know, the good and the bad of rabies is that is 100% fatal if it is contracted and not treated, but it takes months for that to actually occur. So you can wait, you know, up to a couple weeks to initiate rabies therapy with no problems. And the reason why is because rabies treatment and prophylaxis is a pain. It is the day that they come in, they get shots, and then they have to come back at 3, 7, and 14 days for repeat immunization injection. So if somebody is not going to do that, then there's no sense in starting it. And especially for emergency medicine, where a patient population may not come back for, you know, for 2 weeks, then there's no sense in starting it. So having that conversation and letting them know, look, you don't really need it. And, you know, to be honest, if we don't do all 5 of these injections or 4 of these injections, then it really doesn't confer any benefit. So just good conversation, just talking with the patient about it. No raccoons, skunks, foxes, and bats are the absolutes needs to. Cats and dogs, watch the animal, contact animal control, treat if you absolutely have to. But other than that, you can do delayed therapy with no complications.
Awesome. And since we have you right here, thanks for that summary. Just a little bit about publishing. What is scarier, getting bitten by a cat or publishing in JAPA?
It's not so much the getting published. It's, you know, to me, getting it
published is exciting.
Yes, that's, like getting
that's
it
definitely
getting
better
it,
than getting
getting
bit
it
by
submitted
a cat.
is I mean, aside from the time commitment, is not that bad. But what really, you know, gets my anxiety is when I get that email from Reamer that says, hey, your peer review is back. And that I usually need to be in a good mental space for, because, you know, this
it's
is
anonymous.
It's anonymous feedback. This is
That's
your baby. You have been polishing this for however many weeks, if not months, and it comes back and somebody just completely destroys it. And you've got to just have a thick skin and you got to go into it, especially if you've never done it before and you're really worried about whether or not this is something that you can do. It really does knock you down a few pegs, but just know that this is the normal process. And you go through and you just look. A lot of times it is valid feedback, maybe something that you didn't think of, or maybe it was common knowledge to you, but it's not common knowledge to everyone. And you make those adjustments and then put it forward. I mean, sometimes it can be, you know, I've had a few that have been, you know, a little, I don't want to say nasty, but not from JAPA, but have been, you know, attack on, you know, whether or not that this was a topic that needed to be writing on, or if I had the credentials to be able to speak on it as an expert, and, you know, those kind of things. And that just comes with the territory. So just get your feet wet, jump in, publish the stuff that you are interested in. And I guarantee you it'll pay some dividends.
Yeah, for sure. And sometimes you get feedback that says, this looks great. Just go on and publish it.
Yep.
You know,
it's always good for the ego.
Yeah, for sure. Peer review is kind of the best we have. It's definitely not a perfect system, but it shouldn't be something that stops you from publishing. Definitely engage.
Correct.
Chris did it. He is the breakfast cereal champions,
I am.
You can do it too.
Absolutely.
Speaking of, we actually have some original research, and this is by Christy Goodman, who has her master's of public health, and she's a PA, and Christopher M. Black, master of public health as well. And their research is called Patient Knowledge of STI Testing in an Urban Clinic. By the way, Chris, thanks for that. I'm going to go back and say thanks to you and John Hurt for publishing that article. Yeah. And now I'm jumping back forward again. So in summary, the authors wanted to see if people who went to an STI clinic could correctly explain what testing for what diseases they had done. Basically, did they know what they got tested for and what they didn't get tested for, which STIs. And it's really important because there is a little research that says people really misunderstand STI screening. And in the background literature, about 40% of people incorrectly think that STI screening included gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, herpes, HIV, AIDS, HPV, Hep B, and trichomonas. And if you're a provider ordering these things, you know that it's not just a panel that you say STI screening, check, it's all these things. So in the background research, about 40 people got it wrong. We're going to see how many people got it wrong in this study. Some people also think that a pap smear means that STI screening was done. People confuse pap smears and pelvic exams all the time. So a lot of misinformation out there. It's really important because people need to know their STI status to be able to take proper precautions with their partners and know to be screened before they're symptomatic. Sometimes people might assume that any testing they got means testing for everything. I think this is true maybe with not just STI testing, but anything. You ask a patient when their last glucose or cholesterol, and they say, well, I had blood work done, and so it must have been in there. We're missing the boat in communication sometimes. Anyway, it's also really important because in 2015, a couple of years ago, we had the highest rates of chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis than ever before in the United States. So STIs are not going down. They're actually getting worse. There are more than 30 STIs. We usually don't test for all 30 STIs. The CDC recommends that we have conversations about testing for each patient, about the illnesses that we're testing for. So we get this research to say in this one specific urban clinic, what did this look like? So the limitations are that it's from one clinic, it's from an urban area of New Jersey, and also this data is about 7 years old now. This data was all collected in 2011. So you have to ask yourself, is this generalizable to everyone? Maybe not. Do the demographics of this population look like your population? Did anything change in the past 7 years? Does the general public know more or less about STI screening or testing? And realize this was just one clinic. Also, some of the participants in the study knew what testing the clinic provided before they took the survey, so that could have changed some of their answers. So the authors get the data. They look at a lot of different categories, but here they find that about 60% of the people in the study didn't correctly identify what testing they had done. So about 59.3% actually didn't get it right. That's higher than the background research. More people with higher education levels came to be screened before they had symptoms compared to those with lower education levels. And correctly identifying all the STI screening that was done was also associated with the higher education level, meaning education outside of high school. So more education outside of high school, the more education someone had, they were better able to, one, get screened before they had symptoms, and then identify actually what illnesses they had been screened for. If a patient in this survey was unsatisfied with their care, it was usually regarding the demeanor of the provider or the education of the provider. So what's the takeaway? Basically, you need to know the screening guidelines and you need to have really clear conversations with your patients about what screening is available and what screening you're ordering and what that means. It also has implications, and I like that the authors touch on this, to educate, have quality sexual education in primary school. So definitely before someone leaves high school, because there seems to be a difference in knowledge between before graduating high school and after graduating high school, and that there's an opportunity to better educate the public in their earlier years. The other big takeaway is to encourage screening in people who are sexually active, take time to explain what you're doing and the illnesses, what the results are going to mean, what you're ordering and what you aren't, and make sure that you and the patient are on the same page. Because like some of the other things we've talked about today, totally preventable when everyone has the right knowledge and is doing the steps. But, you know, obviously that would be in a kind of perfect world, which we don't live in. But great primary research. Glad that the authors brought this to us.
Yep. Primary research is good. It helps us on the front lines and identify some holes in the care and the conversation with our patients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a good, I mean, we say this every month because JAP is, you know, it's our journal, but I like this is pretty well-rounded one.
Yeah.
We're going to round it off.
Yep.
See what I did
so
there?
Last thing we're going to touch on is QRS of rotator cuff injuries. This is by Nicole Bartoszewski and Nada Parnes, PAs at Tri-County Orthopedics in Carthage, New York. So the nuts and bolts of rotator cuff injuries. Most common cause of shoulder pain in greater than 40-year-olds. Average age of onset is 55 years. The supraspinatus is the most common muscle that is involved, and it commonly occurs secondary to impingement syndromes, degenerative changes, subacromial bone spurs, overload, or overuse injuries. The history all comes down to whether it's acute or chronic. Acute, they're going to come in with a sudden onset of pain and weakness after a known event. Chronic is going to be a slow onset of pain and weakness in the affected arm. Location is typically going to be on the lateral shoulder because that's where the attachment point of the supraspinatus is on the shoulder. And you can have some elbow radiation as well. Physical exam revolves around both the musculature as well as the syndromes. So we're just going to touch on the important special maneuvers. So for impingement syndromes, you're going to do your Hawkins, Kennedy, and your Nears test. That's going to test for subacromial impingement. Testing for the supraspinatus specifically is going to be your empty can or your drop arm. The thing I want to touch on from a pathophysiological standpoint is remember that the shoulder, the deltoid muscle, the lateral head, is what allows the arm to be laterally abducted. So, but that's only going to take over at about 15 to 20%. So the drop arm test is a slow drop where the deltoid is taken over to a certain point where the supraspinatus is then supposed to kick in. And if there's a tear, they're going to have a sudden drop in that arm. Infraspinatus, there's the horn blower maneuver and the external rotation lag sign. For the subscapularis is the belly press or the Gerber test. And then because this is a shoulder pain maneuver, you always want to think about biceps tendonitis in the long head of the biceps. And this is your Jurgensen and your Speeds test. You can go to the article to get descriptions of all of these maneuvers. Imaging, MRI is going to be greater than CT. Sometimes you have to do CT based off of whether or not somebody has medical metal in their body that precludes them from getting an MRI. But MRI is the gold standard. Treatment, conservative, is going to be NSAIDs, PT. You can do subacromial steroid injections to decrease the inflammatory response at that level. If it's an acute tear, a large tear, or there are significant functional limitations, then these should be referred to our orthopedic colleagues for surgical repair. So quick and dirty of rotator cuff injuries.
Awesome.
Yep.
And that does it for us this month.
That does it for us. So sound and sound engineering is done by moi. If you haven't subscribed to our feed on iTunes, please go and give us a rating. It'll help us climb the ranks of iTunes and get the word out. You can tweet at all parties concerned with the podcast, at myself at @PA_Madey. You can tweet at Adrian at @TheArtOfEBM. You can tweet at JAPA at JAPA.com. Or you can tweet at Harrison Reed, our associate editor of JAPA, at Harrison Reed PA.
Yeah. And so even if you don't tweet at us, we hope to meet you back here next month.
That's right. For the May edition, right before the conference.
That's exciting.
It is.
Yeah, 1 year of podcast and right at the conference.
Right. Our anniversary podcast. Yay.
See you in May.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.